So good evening. We have come to chapter 8 in the second book of the Life Divine, Memory, Self-Consciousness, and the Ignorance. This is a chapter that was part of the Arya published in 15 December 1916. The mottos which Sri Aurobindo had originally chosen for that chapter were completely removed. There were two taken from the, I think, the Shvetashvatara Upanishad and from the Isha, which referred to vidya and avidya, knowledge and ignorance, which he found not to be apropos of his main subject as he recast it. This is a chapter that he reworked to some extent. It does not bear the extensive revision that some of the chapters show, but still it has been touched up. It's one of the shorter chapters, and for that reason, we will spend tonight and probably next Sunday night on it and be finished with it. Let's start then with the mottos drawn from Vedic and Vedantic sources, which open the chapter. Memory, self-consciousness, and the ignorance. Some speak of the self-nature, swabhavam, of things. Others say that it is time, kalam. That is from the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Two are the forms, rupe, of Brahman. Time, kala, and cha, the timeless, akala. The third, night, ratri, was born. And from night, the flowing ocean, samudra of being, and on the ocean, time was born, to whom is subjected every seeing creature. Rig Veda, near the end, the 10th mandala, and the hymn was the 190th. There was only one after that, 191, and that was the end of the Veda. The next one, memory, smara, is greater. Without memory, men could think and know nothing. As far as goes the movement of memory, there he ranges at will. This is from the Chandogya Upanishad, one of the oldest. Only the Brihadaranyaka is older. And finally, this is he who is that which sees, drashta, touches, sprashta, hears, shrota, smells, grata, tastes, rasayita, thinks, manta, understands, bodha, acts in us, karta, a conscious being, purusha, a self of knowledge, vijnan atma. This is from the Prashna Upanishad, which is the Upanishad of questions. The first, Shvetashvatara, the Upanishad of the White Horsed One. Prashna, the Upanishad of questions. There are several that are placed to get answers as to the nature of reality, of what is that Brahman. This is from the fourth question concerning sleep, and as translators say, the ultimate basis of things. So you can see that time is seen as an expression through all of these. Memory is what captures and marks moments in time. Who is it that sees? Who is that one who is full, one with that Brahman, and then is capable of undertaking all of these things and composing them in a memory, in the flow of time? He who meditates on memory as Brahman becomes verily that, because you penetrate through the agency of time and the flow of successive moments back into the eternity of which time is an expression, and in that eternity is real being. So I think we can take up the chapter now. In any survey of the dual character of our consciousness, we have first to look at the ignorance. For ignorance trying to turn into knowledge is our normal status. So the dual character is superficially, externally, we are an ignorant being. Internally, in our secret depths, we are made of knowledge, because knowledge is the nature of the self. So we're going to look first at ignorance and then at knowledge. This is following Sri Aurobindo's own adage of old, from the near to the far. Begin with what is near, which is our current experience of ignorance, and proceed, we will, to what seems to be distant, but which is ever present and omnipresent, that only reality. To begin with, it is necessary to consider some of the essential movements of this partial awareness of self and things, which works in us as a mediator between the complete self-knowledge and all knowledge, and the complete in conscience, and from that starting point find its relation to the greater consciousness below our surface. So this is a cosmic placement of ignorance as a diminished, finitized expression of the conscious force of real being. Ignorance, he suggests, is superficial. Below our surface is this oceanic greater consciousness which supports it. There is a line of thought, he writes, in which great stress is laid upon the action of memory. It has even been said that memory is the man. It is memory that constitutes our personality and holds cemented the foundation of our psychological being, for it links together our experiences and relates them to one and the same individual entity. When Sri Aurobindo began this essay in December of 1916, he wrote that European philosophy had it so. And if you look for the actual source of that idea that memory is the man, it's not that easy to distinguish, because the great philosophers of the modern age of European philosophy, Locke, Descartes, etc., did not say that exactly. Let's recall what memory is. Fundamentally, in its simplest definition, it is the power to retain and reproduce mental and emotional and sensory impressions. From the Latin, memoria, which means memory. So it is that which takes our separate experiences and links them together. And the person remembering, we name as one entity, me, right? This is an idea, he says, which takes its stand on our existence in the succession of time and accepts process as the key to essential truth, even when it does not regard the whole of existence as process or as cause and effect in the development of some kind of self-regulating energy, as karma. So this notion of what memory is, that it's equivalent to us as a linking agency, has a worldview which sees that it is the process that gives us access to the essential truth. And that this self-regulating energy by suggestion is karma. That is, karma is an expression of will. With this, we have no problem. Even the external machinery of karma is an expression of some aspect of the cosmic will. We set that aside untouched for the moment. Back to this idea of the process as being key to the essential truth. Sri Aurobindo writes, but process is merely a utility. It is a habitual adoption of certain affective relations which might in the infinite possibility of things have been arranged otherwise for the production of effects which might equally have been quite different. The real truth of things lies not in their process but behind it, in whatever determines, affects, or governs the process, not in effectuation so much as in the will or power that affects, and not so much in will or power as in the consciousness of which will is the dynamic form and in the being of which power is the dynamic value. So we see, tracing this back again all the way to the root of reality, which is Satchit Ananda, existence, consciousness, bliss. It is that existence, Sat, which expresses itself as its own consciousness through its power, which becomes the process. So that is the proper linkage. It is not that process pecks first, it pecks last. But memory, he says, is only a process of consciousness, a utility. It cannot be the substance of being or the whole of our personality. It is simply one of the workings of consciousness, as radiation is one of the workings of light. So the idea of process, of course, he's setting this up so that we do not identify ultimately the nature of our true self as being processive. If that is so, then there is no permanent substance to it. He continues, it is self that is the man. Or if we regard only our normal surface existence, mind is the man, for man is the mental being. Memory is only one of the many powers and processes of the mind, which is at present the chief action of consciousness force in our dealings with self, world, and nature, suggesting that there are other attributes and other utilities that consciousness can use in its play with nature. But mind, right now, is its chief source of action. So in this, he contextualizes memory within the province of mind and mind within the province of a larger manifestation. This idea that it is self that is the man, of course, that's core to that last of the mottos that we saw taken from the Prashna Upanishad. Nevertheless, it is as well to begin with this phenomenon of memory when we consider the nature of the ignorance in which we dwell, for it may give the key to certain important aspects of our conscious existence. We see that there are two applications which the mind makes of its faculty or process of memory: memory of self, memory of experience. First, radically, it applies memory to the fact of our conscious being and relates that to time. It says, I am now, I was in the past, I shall therefore be in the future. It is the same I in all the three ever unstable divisions of time. Thus, it tries to render to itself in the terms of time an account of that which it feels to be the fact, but cannot know or prove to be true, the eternity of the conscious being. We look back and we can see in our past that we have memories and experiences that we retain and can reproduce to our consciousness, and we project the nature of our past experience, which we remember, and what we experience now, and project ourselves into the future. Does that prove that we are eternal? It is a rather superficial view. And it does not, in fact, establish the eternity of the self. By memory, Sri Aurobindo writes, mind can only know of itself in the past, by direct self-awareness only in the moment of the present, and it is only by extension of and inference from this self-awareness and from the memory which tells us that for some time awareness has been continuously existent that mind can conceive of itself in the future. The extent of the past and the future, it cannot fix. It can only carry back the past to the limit of its memory and infer from the evidence of others and the facts of life it observes around it that the conscious being already was in times which it can no longer remember. It knows that it existed in an infant, unreasoning state of the mind to which memory has lost its link. Whether it existed before physical birth, the mortal mind, owing to the gap of memory, cannot determine. Of the future, it knows nothing at all. Of its existing in the next moment, it can only have a moral certainty, which some happening of that moment can prove to be an error, because what it saw was no more than a dominant probability. Much less can it know whether or no physical dissolution is the end of the conscious being. Yet it has this sense of a persistent continuity which easily extends itself into a conviction of eternity. Memory, then, is imperfect and incomplete, and mind, using memory, projecting its gathered facts from the past into the future, erects a rather shaky certitude of an internal self. We can't be certain on this argument that there is at all such a thing. So, memory is not the basis for our conviction that there is something behind the evanescent self which we experience daily coming and going. This conviction, he says, may be either the reflection in the mind of an endless past which it has forgotten, but of which something in it retains the formless impression, or it may be the shadow of a self-knowledge which comes to the mind from a higher or a deeper plane of our being where we are really aware of our eternal self-existence. Or conceivably, it might be a hallucination. So, have we forgotten it? Do we catch a hint from above of something that we secretly are? Are we hallucinating? Just as we cannot sense or realize in our foreseeing consciousness the fact of death, and can only live in the feeling of continued existence, cessation being to us an intellectual conception we can hold with certainty, even imagine with vividness, but never actually realize because we live only in the present, yet death, cessation or interruption, at least of our actual mode of being, is a fact. And the sense or provision of continued existence in the future in the physical body becomes, beyond a point we cannot now fix, a hallucination, a false extension, or a misapplication of our present mental impression of conscious being. So conceivably it might be with this mental idea or impression of conscious eternity. Or it might be a false transference to ourselves of the perception of a real eternity, conscient or inconscient, other than ourselves, the eternity of the universe, or of something which exceeds the universe. The mind, seizing this fact of eternity, may falsely transfer it to our own conscious being, which may be nothing more than a transient phenomenon of that only true eternal. In other words, yes, there may be something that is eternal. The universe, in a way, may itself be eternal if inconscient, if it has no conscious moorings above in an absolute self. Or there may be an absolute self or Brahman, but we, as individuations appearing in the universe, do not participate in that. That continues eternally, but we don't. We come, we go. That continues and ever is. These questions, our surface mind by itself has no means of solving. It can only speculate upon them endlessly and arrive at more or less well-reasoned opinions. The belief in our immortality is only a faith. The belief in our mortality is only a faith. It is impossible for the materialist to prove that our consciousness ends with the death of the body. For he may indeed show that there is as yet no convincing proof that anything in us consciously survives, but equally there is and there can be in the nature of things no proof that our conscious self does not outlast the physical dissolution. In fact, this is a current dialogue being discussed even now in philosophy, in psychology, and appearing in the pages of the Journal of Consciousness Studies. Survival of the body by the human personality may hereafter be proved even to the satisfaction of the skeptic, but even then, what will be established will only be a greater continuity and not the eternity of the conscious being. All we can ascertain by any means possible to the time-bound conscious spirit, the conscious being, is what is true within the nature and scheme of the universe, bound to time. So if we were able to determine that there is something that exceeds the bounds of a human life, that survives death, we would be able to prove only that it has a greater continuity. Not that it is eternal. This, in fact, is the view of one of the secret teachings of Tibetan Buddhism, that there is a drop of honey in the heart that survives death and continues again and again and again. Sounds very like what the Upanishads speak of and what Sri Aurobindo would call the psychic being. But so great an authority is the Dalai Lama has said that no, even that drop of honey in the heart has its end at some point. It is not eternal in time. So this would be akin to that philosophy and that insight. Is this the nature of the self? We find that Sri Aurobindo does not accept that either. In fact, if we look at the mind's concept of this eternity, we see that it comes only to a continuous succession of moments of being in an eternal time. Therefore, it is time that is eternal and not the continuously momentary conscious being. But on the other hand, there is nothing in mind evidence to show that eternal time really exists, or that time itself is anything more than the conscious being's way of looking at some uninterrupted continuity, or it may be, eternity of existence as an indivisible flow which it conceptually measures by the successions and simultaneities of the experiences through which alone that existence is represented to it. This idea that time is eternal has been vacated now in physics, and Sri Aurobindo's language has been carefully composed to be consonant with the relativistic ideas of Einstein's views. He continues, if there is an eternal existence, which is a conscious being, it must be beyond time, which it contains, timeless, as we say. It must be the eternal of the Vedanta, who, we may then conjecture, uses time only as a conceptual perspective for his view of his self-manifestation. So the perspective is a utility for the manifestation. But the timeless, he continues, but the timeless self-knowledge of this eternal is beyond mind. It is a supramental knowledge, superconscient to us and only to be acquired by the stilling or transcending of the temporal activity of our conscious mind, by an entry into silence or a passage through silence into the consciousness of eternity. So here, drawing from the nature of his own experience, he would say that we must leave the flow of time in the active world and rise into the spiritual freedom of a silence, and from that silence rise to a still higher height into the supramental, which brings together what to the mind are antinomies, silence and active world. From all this, the one great fact emerges that the very nature of our mind is ignorance, not an absolute nescience, but a limited and conditioned knowledge of being, limited by a realization of its present, a memory of its past, an inference of its future, conditioned, therefore, by a temporal and successive view of itself and its experiences. So, to the ignorance of the mind, we measure time in the line of an arrow, from past, distant behind us. Here we sit in the present, and the arrow continues into the future. Sri Aurobindo continues, if real existence is a temporal eternity, then the mind has not the knowledge of real being. For even its own past it loses in the vague of oblivion, except for the little that memory holds. It has no possession of its future, which is withheld from it in a great blank of ignorance. It has only a knowledge of its present, changing from moment to moment in a helpless succession of names, forms, happenings, the march or flux of a cosmic kinesis which is too vast for its control or its comprehension. On the other hand, if real existence is a time-transcending eternity, the mind is still more ignorant of it, for it only knows the little of it that it can itself seize from moment to moment by fragmentary experience of its surface self-manifestation in time and space. So reality as temporal, reality as eternal. With the temporal reality, our grasp is flitting, is partial, is uncertain, has gaps in it. Whose memory is complete? None. The present, changing from moment to moment in a succession that never ends. This is the self and the nature as described by Heraclitus in Greece and Buddha in India. So, now he comes to a reframing of the issue. If then mind is all, or if the apparent mind in us is the index of the nature of our being, we can never be anything more than an ignorance fleeting through time and catching at knowledge in a most scanty and fragmentary fashion. But if there is a power of self-knowledge beyond mind, which is timeless in essence, and can look on time, perhaps with a simultaneous, all-relating view of past, present, and future, but in any case, as a circumstance of its own timeless being, then we have two powers of consciousness, knowledge and ignorance, the Vedantic Vidya and Avidya. This idea of a view which sees simultaneously past, present, and future is the Trikala Drishti, the triple view of time, the seeing of all the three states of time, which is characteristic of the supramental consciousness. This, Sri Aurobindo will say, is the nature of the actual manifestation, because he can confirm that it is based on his actual spiritual experience. And we're back to knowledge and ignorance, vidya and avidya. Avidya is not its opposite, but ignorance is a restricted power of that knowledge, which is a fulsome expression of conscious force, the nature of sat, existence. These two must be then either different and unconnected powers, separately born as well as diverse in their action, separately self-existent in an eternal dualism, or else, if there is a connection between them, it must be this, that consciousness as knowledge knows its timeless self and sees time within itself, while consciousness as ignorance is a partial and superficial action of the same knowledge which sees rather itself in time, veiling itself in its own conception of temporal being, and can only by the removal of the veil return to eternal self-knowledge. So it is a self-veiling, which is the nature of the ignorance. It is not something that happens adventitiously. It is self-chosen. That great free knowledge intentionally closets itself in this restriction that we call ignorance, and which allows the apparent dualities and the confusing aspects of the world to come into being, but always within it is this power which is self-owned to remove the veil and to return to the eternity, and to do that through self-knowledge. This, you might recall, takes us back to those verses about vidya and avidya in the Isha Upanishad and in the Rig Veda, especially with the image of that golden lid, having to push through that golden lid to get through the truth beyond, the larger reality. So I think this is where we will put our bookmarks tonight, and we'll take up the balance of this chapter next week. Tonight I've got a passage to read to you from Savitri, Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds. I cheated a little. This is from Canto 4, The Kingdoms of the Little Life. But you'll see what I'm driving at by bringing in this piece of his brilliant poetry. A master of his life's environment, a leader of a huddled human mass, herding for safety on a dangerous earth, he gathered them round him as if minor powers, to make a common front against the world. Or weak and soul on an indifferent earth, as a fortress for his undefended heart, or else to heal his body's loneliness. In others than his kind he sensed a foe, an alien unlike force to shun and fear, a stranger and adversary to hate and slay. Or he lived as lives a solitary brute, at war with all, he bore his single fate. Absorbed in the present act, the fleeting days, none thought to look beyond the hour's gains, or dreamed to make this earth a fairer world, or felt some touch divine surprise his heart. The gladness that the fugitive moment gave, the desire grasped, the bliss, the experience won, movement and speed and strength were joy enough, and bodily longing shared, and quarrel and play, and tears and laughter, and the need called love. In war and clasp, these life wants joined the all-life, wrestlings of a divided unity, inflicting mutual grief and happiness in ignorance of the self forever one. Arming its creatures with delight and hope, a half-awakened nescience struggled there to know by sight and touch the outside of things. Instinct was formed. In memory's crowded sleep, the past lived on as in a bottomless sea. Inverting into half-thought the quickened sense, she felt around for truth with fumbling hands, clutched to her the little she could reach and seize, and put aside in her subconscient cave. So must the dim being grow in light and force, and rise to his higher destiny at last, look up to God and round at the universe, and learn by failure and progress by fall, and battle with environment and doom, by suffering, discover his deep soul, and by possession, grow to his own vasts. So. Namaste. Jai Ma.